The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Hopefully you had a nice weekend. We're off and running on another productive week. We hope it will be a productive week here for the program and, of course, for all of us as we lend our support to God's end-time work. On today's program, we're going to be looking at some of the history going back to the first or the original Jeroboam, back in 1 Kings 11 and 12, I think it is. But that was a study we didn't have time for, I think, last Thursday. So hopefully we'll make a little more time for that coming up in the second half of today's show. And if we have some time on top of that, we've got some feedback that's been piling up here for a few days. So hopefully we can relay some of that to you as well. Well, it was on this day, 101 years ago, that the First World War ended. We talked quite a bit about that last year at this time at the 100-year anniversary. But 101 years, going back all the way to 1918, when 20 million people over the course of that 4 or 5 year war, called the Great War, 20 million people perished in that worldwide conflict. And it's always inspiring here in the UK to see the parades. Of course, they wear the little poppy pins on their lapel for the first couple of weeks of November. But they really do, on their, I guess, their Memorial Day, they really do remember, or they try to remember, I think, in more ways than we do in the United States with Memorial Day or Veterans Day. But there's so many lessons to take away from that history, so many lessons that we don't want to forget. I've put together some material for our Winston Churchill class, which I'll give later on today. But it's just, you know, when you talk about the point that my father's made in the literature before about how that the Worldwide Church of God, following the death of Herbert Armstrong, they didn't want to assign blame. They talked about how circumstances or events led to the start or the outbreak of World War I. It certainly wasn't Germany. And yet, when you read Winston Churchill's writings, when you look at his writings on the First World War, the Great Crisis, as he called it, he assigns blame, you can be sure. He said in his work, or his history, Germany, it seemed, had rushed with head down and settled resolve to her own undoing. He said she had put herself so hopelessly in the wrong. This was Britain's enemy there in the early part of the 20th century. And of course, that history played out yet again in the 1940s, the late 30s and the 1940s. But here he is writing the World Crisis. I think he wrote it in 1931. So this was before World War II, but a little over a decade after the Great War ended. And he talked about Germany triggering this crisis. In fact, when he first came on as First Lord of the Admiralty, when he headed up the Navy, that was going back to 1911, I think it was. He's just in that office for a few months, and in February of 1912, he gives this well-known speech up in Glasgow, Scotland, in which he talked about the Navy race, comparing the British Navy to the German Navy. And he said there's a difference between the two. He said that for the British, the Navy is a necessity, whereas for the Germans, a Navy is more of a luxury. He said we need a Navy because it involves or ensures or protects British existence. But for Germany, it's more about expansionism. Well, after he finished with that speech, there were a lot of people in Germany who were very upset by that message. And there were a lot in the liberal press, the Western press, who were also upset with Winston Churchill. How could he say something like that about the German Navy? Well, look at how Germany used its Navy just a few short years later. And then the history repeats itself in the late 1930s and the 1940s. And yes, as your Bible prophesies, it's going to repeat itself one final time. GermanForeignPolicy.com. It had a posting just the other day about how that leading German politicians are demanding a more aggressive foreign and military policy. Europe urgently needs to learn the language of power, says Ursula von der Leyen. She's the president-elect of the European Commission, and she's talking about Europe urgently needing to learn the language of power. We have to in this modern world. Look at the course that the world is on, they're saying in Europe. And we've got to have this language of power ourselves. And of course, Germany is the one that's expected to take the lead. She went on to say how important it was for Germany to build its own or strengthen its own muscles. So they want a stronger, unified military. And there you have the United States encouraging them to do it. The United States, and I suppose to some degree, Great Britain as well. Over the weekend, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell, he was speaking on one of the Fox News programs with Neil Cavuto, and Cavuto asked him about NATO and just, well, it was following the anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down. We talked about that on Friday's program, but he's bringing up some of the history. Cavuto is. You'll hear him ask the question at the start, and then listen to the German ambassador's response. Our U.S. ambassador to Germany, I should say, his response to NATO and every member paying their fair share. This is clip two.
You know, Ambassador, you think about it, there are so many young people who don't even remember the significance of this day or the fact that we used to have two Germanies. And it's something the president reminds even the Germans themselves about, that they have to pony up more to be a member of NATO. He's argued they're slack in how much they contribute. They're well shy of the 2% of their GDP that other countries contribute. The German reaction tends to be shrugged shoulders. What do you get from them?
Well, I would say that's true over the past several years. Certainly in the Bush administration that I worked in and the Obama administration, we asked the Germans and Europeans to increase their defense spending. We did it very nicely, and so that didn't really work. And now we've tried a new style where President Trump is being very direct. His tweets are very direct. His requests of Germany are very direct. And we've got to look at the fact that the different style is actually working. I know some people in Washington and in the media like to complain about it, but the facts are that the different style is working. We've seen $100 billion increase in European spending on defense since President Trump really started pushing, since 2016. And so that success, I think, you cannot argue with. And just yesterday, we had the defense minister of Germany, a new defense minister, commit to getting to the 2% by 2031. And I think that's a bold step. It's not fast enough. Of course, the deadline has been 2024.
Right.
But
right.
I think that the Germans, the largest economy, are now trying to do something like that. And we're going to complement it.
So it's already changing. It's going in a different direction now. And for the U.S., it's not fast enough. We want to see it go faster. We want to see them put more money into this. More money into the military. More effort and energy into military union. Now, Mr. Armstrong, as you know, Herbert Armstrong, he talked about the rise of this European power. Following World War II, even. Well, even before World War II. But while Germany was just ruined, lying under rubble, following the years after the Second World War, here comes Mr. Armstrong prophesying of political, economic, and military integration in Europe. A massive European empire. Now, that economic union, that's already established. And the political union, there's a strengthening that's going to come. But certainly the framework is there. And then we're getting we're in the early stages of military union. And of course, we've had a lot to say about this over the years at thetrumpet.com. And there have been other statements along the way, not just recently here with the president-elect of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. But here she is now saying that Europe needs to speak the language of power. We need to speak the language of power. And the U.S. is there encouraging this growth, this strength, this flexing of muscles. And the Daniel 8 man, he's also discussed in Daniel 11. He's not even yet on the scene. What happens when this man of flatteries comes in and rallies the nations of Europe? Well, what happens is more Bible prophecy is fulfilled. Listen to what Herbert Armstrong said on one of his old radio programs, clip 3.
Gradually and now faster and faster, a new power is being developed from underneath the surface, a new world power, which the public now least suspects, which the world does not yet see, doesn't realize, doesn't dream is coming, but it is developing just as prophesied in Europe, a resurrected Roman Empire that will combine some 350 millions of population, a power so mighty that our Western peoples will stand aghast when it flashes suddenly into full being. Yes, your Bible says that the world will be startled.
The whole world's going to be startled, shocked when they see this beast power finally emerge. And it involves, as I read to you earlier, or paraphrase, I guess, just to paraphrase some of our literature, it involves economic union, political union, and yes, military union as well. Here's how Mr. Armstrong put it in a sermon from the 1980s, clip 4.
Well, what they want is political union. What they want is one military force. What they want is one great world power.
A great world power backed by one common unified military force. And here's Ursula von der Leyen saying, we need to speak. Europe urgently needs to learn and speak the language of power. Well, we've got a few other news items to get to when we come back. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The Holy Roman Empire has made pivotal and defining contributions to Western civilization. But its many reincarnations have also come with painful and catastrophic consequences. European leaders aim to unite the fractured continent of Europe by reviving the legacy of this extraordinary church-state combine. One of the great lessons of this empire is that it always comes back. There is always another resurrection. To understand much more on this vital subject, call now and request our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The Holy Roman Empire is not just a relic of history. It is about to play a central role in world events. Coming to understand about the nature and character of this powerful institution tells you as much about the future as it does about the past.
as part of this free offer, also request Herbert Armstrong's classic work, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Both booklets are available at no cost or obligation to you. In addition to the free book, you may also request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet examines world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
There is going to be a resurrection of that old Roman Empire. Not very many people believe it, because people have gotten completely beyond really believing that the Bible means what it says. You're going to have to live and see it, and you're going to have to know that God was speaking when he said this thing is coming.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Facebook and YouTube have decided to remove all content from their platforms that mentions the anti-Trump whistleblower. You've heard about the whistleblower. His name was revealed at Real Clear Investigations, talked about on talk radio. But here come Facebook and YouTube. This is from The Federalist. It says, according to CNN, a YouTube spokesperson said videos mentioning the whistleblower's name will be removed. The removal of content will be applicable not only to titles and descriptions of the videos, but the video's content as well. You can't say the name. Never have they been so protective of a whistleblower. But you see why they are now. They're all in it together. They're all in on it. The conspiracy, the coup, as we covered last week. And if the major media says, don't mention him, then here are the social media sites obediently complying. Matt Tabibi, or Tabi, I guess. I forget how you pronounce his name. But he writes at Rolling Stone. He's left wing, but he was against the Russia collusion nonsense from the beginning. And he says here, why is Christopher Steele still a thing? And we'll come back to the Christopher Steele point he makes in just a moment. But he makes another point deeper into his article about CNN and Jake Tapper, who wrote to BuzzFeed, the editor, Ben Smith, back in 2017. And Tapper was complaining that Smith had been irresponsible and uncollegial by publishing the dossier. Why was he upset that BuzzFeed published the dossier in its entirety? It says Tapper was mad that Smith had defamed the story by showing where it came from. He wasn't mad that the content was put out there. But he gave the whole dossier. He put it all out there and made it obvious then where it was coming from as well. Christopher Steele, the DNC, and so on. And this quote's from an email that Tapper sent to Smith. I guess this came out in a court case of some kind. But he said here, I think your move makes the story less serious and credible. He wrote in an email produced as part of a lawsuit against BuzzFeed, I think you damaged its impact. And then to be at Rolling Stone says, Tapper apparently liked the Steele tale better when it was coming out in bits through more politically astute sources like his buddy and future co-worker and former director of national intelligence, James Clapper. It says the now accepted notion that Steele's importance lay in his central claim. See, there's a lot of people that knew that the dossier and the contents of the dossier, that it was just nonsense, that it was just based on hearsay, a bunch of lies. But they all believe that the central claim was true. the fact that Donald Trump was some kind of a secret Russian agent. And so, okay, don't put everything out there. Don't reveal all the details. But let's just let it trickle out and keep coming back to that central claim. Russian collusion. It says the headline of Steele's first report was about Trump's compromising relationship with the Kremlin and the heavy focus on the original, i.e. non-verifiable material in the dossier, the so-called two-way Trump-Russia plot. To be at Rolling Stone says the original source of this madness was Steele. We now know it's madness because of the Mueller report. And Steele's the original, he's the original source. He's the one that compiled all of this content. It says, and the media and political figures who leaned with all their might into this phony narrative. So Steele and the media, they leaned with all their might to support this phony narrative. And of course, it was backed by Hillary Clinton's campaign. It was opposition research. They were looking for dirt on a political opponent and getting all these nations involved. And here, look at the latest in their narrative that they keep spinning every day. It's all that you see in the clips I look at Grabian or wherever. The phone conversation with Ukraine, that's still topic number one. That's still the number one headline. And you have news media telling young people even, look, pay attention. This is historic, these impeachment proceedings. Tabi at Rolling Stone says that the media, Steele, all of these players, they should be embarrassed. But they're not. They've just moved on to the next narrative, or they put a little bit of a different spin on it. But the what this reveals is they want to control YouTube, Google, Facebook, the major media. They want to control the narrative. Jake Tapper wants it to be kind of leaked out little by little and framed in a certain way. Never forget the central claim. Never mind if the facts or the evidence don't back it up. We know he's a secret Russian agent. And that's all that you need to know. It's not about exposing the truth. It's about convincing people to accept their agenda or their narrative. Now, listen to this story from The Guardian. This was last week. It says Boris Johnson was on Monday, switching gears here a little bit, but it ties right in. This is the UK now. It says Boris Johnson was on Monday night accused of presiding over a cover-up after it emerged that Number 10 refused to clear the publication of a potentially incendiary report examining Russian infiltration in British politics. Russian infiltration into British politics. Does this sound familiar? It says Downing Street indicated on Monday that it would not allow a 50-page dossier from the Intelligence and Security Committee to be published before the election, prompting a string of complaints over its suppression. So Downing Street won't let this dossier go out. And so now the story, or at least for The Guardian, I don't think it gained much traction because it's so ridiculous. But still, there's plenty of people out there that will believe it. I'll point you to another story here in just a second to show that. But now he's accused of covering it up. It says the committee's chairman called the decision jaw-dropping, saying no reason for the refusal had been given. Fresh evidence has also emerged of attempts by the Kremlin, to infiltrate the conservatives. See, they've infiltrated the Republican Party in the United States, and they've also infiltrated the conservatives. Where's this coming from? This narrative. It says, infiltrate the conservatives by a senior Russian diplomat suspected of espionage who spent 5 years in London cultivating leading Tories, including Johnson himself. So it was a 5-year project to cultivate Boris Johnson, to prepare him, or to turn him into a secret Russian agent. Listen to this. It only gets better. It says, it can now be revealed that Sergei Nalabin, who once described the future prime minister as our good friend, lives in a Moscow apartment known as the FSB house because it houses so many employees from the Kremlin's main spy agency. The committee's report is based on analysis from Britain's intelligence agencies as well as third-party experts such as the former MI6 officer Christopher Steele. I'm not making this up. This is from The Guardian last week. Here is Christopher Steele again. And I think the first line of the dossier in America aimed at Donald Trump said that the Russian agents had been working for 5 years to cultivate Donald Trump. And it's the same exact narrative, the same storyline. It's from The Guardian. I mean, The Guardian's so far to the left, it's tipped over. It never stops. And so this author at Rolling Stone says, why is Christopher Steele still a thing? How has this happened? Why is he still around? Well, very simply, because there are people out there who want to believe this. They want to believe the central claim that a conservative or a Republican, in fact, they're Russian spies. This is from The Telegraph. It says, it will come as a surprise to few that 54% of 18 to 24-year-olds plan to vote Labor in this election, compared to just 13% for the conservatives. So young people overwhelmingly vote Labor. Only 13% vote conservative. That's according to YouGov. It says, more intriguing is the striking parallel with data from university lecturers. 56% of the latter support Labor and 11% the Tories. So the children, not surprisingly, the students, they vote the same way that their professors do. And in the university, the professors are liberal. Most of them are left-wing, radically left-wing. It says that our higher education institutions are churning out record numbers of ill-educated, left-leaning graduates is no secret. Then it goes on to point out how that a few years ago, there was a poll that found that 70% of young people had no idea who Mao Zedong is or was. It says this particular example chimes troublingly with our metropolitan elite's disgraceful ignorance of communism's worst horrors. Last year, Jeremy Corbyn, that is, praised China's great leap forward in an interview with Andrew Marr. Mao's policy of forced collectivism of agriculture, caused the deaths of 45 million people. That a majority of young people would vote for a party led by someone who arguably endorses the policies of the greatest mass murderer in history isn't the only reason why the massive expansion of higher education sector was a mistake. Jeremy Corbyn, he leads the left-wing party, the Labor Party. And lots of young people vote for him, vote for that party. And lots of them are convinced that the evil villain in London is Boris Johnson, or in Washington, D.C., it's Donald Trump. Well, he makes a couple of other points about how that besides the left-wing propaganda, there's a lot of other things about higher education that are problematic. But they desperately want to control the narrative. They want to make sure they can frame the story just the way you need to see it. And meanwhile, the actual coup, the actual conspiracy it's right there in plain view for those who have eyes to see. Nikki Haley was interviewed over the weekend. I guess it was yesterday. She has a new book coming out. And she writes about John Kelly and Rex Tillerson, these two guys that used to be in the Trump administration in that first year. And she says how that those two were looking to undermine President Trump's agenda. They're no longer with the administration. But listen to the reporter. There's a little bit of the narration before the exchange between the reporter and Nikki Haley. She used to be the U.N. ambassador, President Trump's U.N. ambassador, the first 2 years of his administration. Here's clip one.
Haley recounts a closed-door encounter with then-White House Chief of Staff John Kelly and then-Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Kelly and Tillerson confided in me that when they resisted the president, they weren't being insubordinate, they were trying to save the country.
And then the Secretary of State Tillerson went on to tell you the reason he resisted the president's decisions was because if he didn't, people would die. Do you memorialize that conversation? It definitely happened?
It absolutely happened. And instead of saying that to me, they should have been saying that to the president, not asking me to join them on their sidebar plan. It should have been, go tell the president what your differences are and quit if you don't like what he's doing. But to undermine a president is really a very dangerous thing. And it goes against the Constitution and it goes against what the American people want. And it was offensive.
That's Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador. And, you know, she's had her exchanges with Donald Trump before. And apparently, you know, they got past that. And then she got that appointment to the UN, was there for a couple of years. But John Kelly, he was the chief of staff, I believe. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. These two powerful positions. And according to her, they're there saying, look, we're going to try to undermine the president where we can. We've got to do it because people will die if we don't. Just open insubordination, which is dangerous, as she brings out, correctly so. And it's unconstitutional. Here's the conspiracy. And then you can add all the others, all the others to the mixed. The whistleblower. The fact that they don't want you to know his name. They don't want you to know that he worked for Joe Biden or Susan Rice or that he's a left-wing activist. They don't want you to know any of these things. They've got to frame it just so. And then the open insubordination, well, that's fine. As long as you're resisting, if you're part of the resistance, that's okay. It's astounding, again, to see the media not just complicit, but leading the charge, controlling the narrative. And then Facebook and Google and YouTube, they're all happy to support the effort to bring down a presidency or to bring down the prime minister here in the UK. Lies, use it again. Recycle the dossier if you have to. Let's just tell the same tale and apply it to Boris Johnson this time around and see if it sticks. With some, sadly, it will. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. As I say, if you'd like to email the program, send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back with our Bible study.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more,
request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
In 1 Kings 11, we're introduced to an individual named Jeroboam. He was an evil king in ancient Israel, one that broke free from the throne of David, David's throne, and Jerusalem. And you read about how talented and energetic he was, a very ambitious man. Solomon, before he died, really entrusted him with quite a few projects in and around Jerusalem. It says in 1 Kings 11:28, "And the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing the young man, that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph." He was over both Ephraim and Manasseh, all of Joseph, it says. He was an ambitious man. And as I say, Solomon made him into this, so almost like a superintendent of the public works projects around Jerusalem. Well, in verse 29, Ahijah the prophet comes to Jeroboam with a message. This is the prophet who succeeded Nathan and Gad during the time of David. And he took off the coat that he was wearing. He ripped it into 12 pieces. And then he handed 10 of the pieces to Jeroboam. Notice verse 31, it says, "And he said to Jeroboam, take you 10 pieces for... Thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes to you. But he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen, out of all the tribes of Israel." So the garment, rather, it clearly symbolizes the kingdom of Israel, and the 10 pieces represent the 10 tribes that would follow after Jeroboam. He would, as I say, break away from Jerusalem and from the throne of David and later establish a headquarters in Samaria, north of Jerusalem. Verse 36 says, "And unto his son will I give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light alway before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me, to put my name there." So a light, so to speak, had to keep burning forever. This throne of David in Jerusalem initially, and then it moved from one place to the next. But the light was always burning, always glowing, because of the promise, obviously, that God had made to David, the covenant that he made surrounding that throne. Verse 37, "And I will take you, and you shall reign according to all that your soul desires, and shall be king over Israel. And it shall be, if you will hearken..." This is incredible that God said this to Jeroboam. I mean, God was behind Jeroboam's rule. He was behind it, the original Jeroboam. "And I will take you, and you shall reign..." It says, "And you shall reign according to all that your soul desires, and shall be king over Israel, and it shall be, if you will hearken unto all that I command you, and will walk in my ways, and do that is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with you, and build you a sure house, as I built for David, and will give Israel unto you." God actually offered to prosper him, to prosper Israel, to prosper these ten tribes. Well, verse 40, though, it says, Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So Solomon obviously heard about this prophecy. God, again, gave this message to Jeroboam through a prophet. And so he went after Jeroboam, and Jeroboam fled. So that then sets the stage for this conflict, this civil war that would happen following Solomon's death. A civil war that would actually split the kingdom of Israel into two nations. Notice chapter 12 and verse 16. It says, so when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king and said, what portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, David. So Israel departed unto their tents. They departed. They revolted against Rehoboam. When they sent Adoram, the chief tax collector, they stoned him to death. Rehoboam had to flee. But notice it also says that the people of Israel, they rebelled against David's house. What portion have we in David? They asked. Verse 19 says, so Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day. It continues, even unto this day. And notice it says they weren't just rebelling against Rehoboam. They were rebelling against the house of David. This is Jeroboam's great sin, that he rejected the house of David. And of course, this is critical history for our understanding because we're seeing it happen again, an end-time fulfillment. Prophecy is dual, or so much of this history, this prophecy, as a dual application. And God says there would be a Jeroboam type in this end time who would also rebel against the house of David. In the former prophet's book, it says, just as ancient Israel rebelled against the house of David, the nations of Israel today do as well. And spiritually, most of God's people are rebelling against the house of David. It continues unto this day, and most in Israel, physical and spiritual, are rebelling against this house, this throne, this godly authority. Verse 20, it says, and it came to pass when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, that they sent and called him unto the congregation and made him king over Israel. And there was none that followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. So Israel, the majority of Israelites, they rejected Rehoboam, they rejected the throne of David, they rejected Jerusalem, and they selected Jeroboam instead. This was all in fulfillment of prophecy. Remember, the prophet who came to reveal this to Jeroboam. The people chose Jeroboam. He was a man of the people. He considered what the people said. Rehoboam, remember, he sought his inner circle when the people complained that the taxes were too oppressive, and then went and added more taxes to the mix. But Jeroboam, the Jeroboam of old, he listened to the people. He was a man of the people. Well, it's interesting, the other day, or last week, we talked about that prophecy in Hosea 5. Remember how Ephraim, Hosea 5:11, walks after the commandment of Jeroboam. Both nations, Ephraim and Manasseh, he was appointed over Joseph early on in the story, back during the days of Solomon, as we've already read. And so how significant is this history? All of these parallels. Verse 26 in chapter 12 here, it says, "And Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So he, as I say, he was a man of the people. He feared the people in this case. He also didn't want them going back down to Jerusalem and getting involved in any of the religious festivities or activities there. All of these God-commanded festivals and holy days. And so he rejected all of that and instead created this counterfeit, this false system of worship. He was a very religious individual, no doubt about it. But it wasn't God's religion. It wasn't based on the truth of the Bible. Remember, his problem, my father brings this out in the former prophets, is that he hated David's house. And he didn't want any of the Israelites going back to that area, Jerusalem. It says in the former prophets, "This attitude in Jeroboam and the people led to what I believe is the greatest disaster in the history of Israel up until the time right ahead of us. Israel was conquered and lost its identity because of it. Because they rejected the house of David, because they hated the house of David, they hated the throne of David. God wants us looking to that throne. God wants us looking to Jerusalem. God wants for Jerusalem to be our chief joy, it says in the Psalms. It says in verse 28 here, "Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set the one in Bethel, and he put the other in Dan. So he says, look, it's too much for you to go back to Jerusalem. I've got these other systems of worship in place at Bethel, at Dan, and you can worship there instead. He knew what he was doing. He knew it was wrong. But a lot of people went right along with it. Well, what do we have to do with the house of David anyway? So many of them thought. So many of them reasoned. Look at how quickly the majority turned to other gods. It's too much. It's too much to obey God the way God says to do it. It's too much to do it the way King David originally said. This is the way so many preachers reason today. They speak smooth things. They tell you how easy it is. You just have to commit in your heart, and that's it. You don't have to actually do anything. You don't have to actually obey God's commandments. It's the same exact story today. Here you've got a Jeroboam administration, and it has the full support of so many people in the traditional Christian world. They love it. They love each other. But in fact, it's taking us, our nations, further and further away from God, this great false system. Verse 30, it says, "And this thing became a sin, and the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. And he made a house of high places, and made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi." So he established a priesthood. He made a house of high places, all places that they could worship, instead of Jerusalem. He didn't do it the way God said to do it. He did it his own way. Verse 32, "And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the eighth month, on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that is in Judah. And he offered upon the altar, so did he in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made." So he just moved it all back a month. God's festivals, of course, are in the commanded ones, as outlined in your Bible. They're in the seventh month of the sacred calendar. Here, he just moves it back a month. And you see here, I mean, it's very similar to the way human nature works today. He just took a religious-sounding festival. He made it himself. And he said, this is what's important. This is the system of worship that you should concern yourselves with. And it was easier. He didn't have to go. People didn't have to go down to Jerusalem. But of course, the bottom line here is that it wasn't commanded by God. It wasn't God's festival. We're here to observe the commandments of God, to do what God says to do. And like I've said recently at the college, look at how much trouble we avoid by just simply following the instructions of God, by just simply following in the steps of King David or some of the other patriarchs of old, or our heroes in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, Peter, and the others. In 2 Kings, it talks about Jeroboam, this same Jeroboam who made Israel to sin. He made them sin. He was the cause, because he erected this false system of worship. It was still very religious, humanly speaking, but it wasn't God's religion. As I say, there's lots and lots of parallels, lots for us to take away from this history, and perhaps we can delve further into it at a later time. Well, since I have the class later on, I'll just leave off a little bit early and save some of these emails for a later program, maybe tomorrow, we'll see. But we thank you for joining us today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll see you tomorrow.